There are many things in this modern world that we tend to take for granted. We very much live in an age of convenience, but some of us are old enough to remember that the computer has only been a household item for about the last 15, 20 years. I still remember my first computer, and even saw an image the other day of, in the early 1950s, how much space a 10 gigabyte hard drive took up, and it was massive, about the size of a piano. And now we have electronics that fit in our pockets that have more power than those things ever dreamed of having. But this computer technology has permeated almost everything we have. Obviously, electronics, DVD players, tablet computers, smartphones, even smart TVs now that are connected. But even in our cars, you can get cars that are now equipped with what they call mobile hotspots that have it in there. But even the car itself, most cars have more electronics than we would ever dream of, even years ago, the technology that's involved there. There are quite a few less technologically sophisticated items that have also made quite a difference, a contribution to our overall quality of life as well. And there was a survey done back at the end of last century, a few years ago, and they were, the question was, what was the most important invention of the 20th century? Now, you look at the 20th century and all of the advances that were made, what would you pick? But the winner was the toothbrush, which seems like a very odd thing, but when you think about the impact something as simple as oral hygiene has and how simple a device that it is, this was what won out. Something to think about. But along that line, imagine stopping a day's work once the sun went down. That's not too long ago. You got up when the sun came up. You went to bed when the sun went down because you didn't have any light. Now, you could have lanterns. You could have candles. You could have other things, but that got expensive. They were more an item that was used when you had to. It wasn't a luxury item that you just left on or burning, if you will. That changed about 100 years ago with the invention of the light bulb. And the light bulb was truly revolutionary. It created a modern society that we have now, helped to create it, because now work could be extended past those daylight hours. And the light then began to affect those light bulbs, having electric light, began to impact other areas of life as well. I believe the light bulb is one of the most relevant or far-reaching, impactful things of the 1900s, because we have, much like computers, we have lights everywhere now in our society. You open the refrigerator, you got a light. You open the freezer, you got a light. You have night lights. You open the car door, you got a light. We've got lights on all of our electronics. We have lights all over the place, and we have lights of all different types. Small lights, you know, that just light up a small area, or we have big spotlights that we can light up huge sections of parking areas. But I believe there, part of the reason why the light bulb was so impactful was not only its application, but the simplicity of it itself. Now, it took men like Thomas Edison a great deal of work to come up with light bulb, but it is really a very simple thing. You have in it, or contained within it, basically four elements. You have the bulb itself, the glass part. You have the filament, which is the part that heats up, that resists the electricity, that creates the light. Then you have the filament mount, what that is attached to, and you have the base that connects to the electricity. And in simple terms, that's a light. That's all that's necessary for it to do what it needs to do. The other thing is that lights are easy to operate. You turn the switch and it comes on. You turn the switch and it goes off. And so we can place them wherever we need them. They're very easy to use and it produces the light that we need. Today we're going to take a look at this analogy and draw it out into some other areas. We're going to look at how a light bulb produces light, and then how that relates to you and me. So the title of my message today simply is A Light to the World. Now, I mentioned those light bulb parts, but a major hurdle in producing reliable light was to come up with what could be used for a filament. And if you ever want to read some interesting history, you can go back and read what Thomas Edison went through. I don't think there was a material known that he didn't try to use in the filament. He used strings, he used different wires of various compositions. He tried all kinds of things. The solution came down to a high-resistant metal, high-heat-resistant metal, and that's mostly tungsten. Tungsten takes a lot of energy before it disintegrates, and that's part of the problem. When you create light, you're pushing a lot of electricity through this material at resistance, and so it creates heat, and a byproduct of the heat is the light. And so many of these filaments that would be tried would simply burn up. They would disappear within a few minutes, in some cases, maybe a few hours or a day or two, but you need a light bulb that lasts for 10,000s of hours for it to be practical. The other thing that they came up with is that they needed to remove the oxygen from within the bulb, because oxygen is very corrosive. It reacts heavily with a lot of things. And so they put in various inert gases. Most light bulbs that are incandescent use argon, which doesn't react. So it creates a natural vacuum that's not going to facilitate the light bulb just burning out. So let's begin with by turning to Matthew 5. Christ used this analogy as well. I don't know that he had a light bulb necessarily in mind, but there was a contemporary version of this, whether it was a candle or whether it was an oil lamp. And so here in Matthew 5 and verse 14, he simply is telling those that he's talking to here, speaking to, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden." So I suspect most of you have gone out at some evening, doesn't matter what time of year, but if you especially live outside of the city areas, that you can look off in a distance and see somewhere that there's a light on. It could be a neighbor like me. I've got neighbors out the back looking across the valley there. They're probably 2 miles away. But if they walk out and turn on their outside back porch light, I can see that light like that. I may not see what's in their backyard as well, but I can see that light. And I think that's an interesting analogy to draw here, that we're the light of the world. We don't have to be the most powerful thing around. We don't have to light up everything around us. We don't have to make a big statement, but we're noticed. If we continue in verse 15, he says, "Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand." If you're going to turn a light on, you want it to be where it does the most good, where it illuminates the most area. He says, so you put it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." I read this brief statement from the Daily Bible Study by Barclay on this section. He says, "It may be well said that this is the greatest compliment that was ever paid to the individual Christian. For in it, Jesus commands the Christian to be what he himself claimed to be. And Christ said, 'As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world.' When Jesus commanded his followers to be the lights of the world, he demanded nothing less than they should be like himself." So what kind of light are we? Let's go next to Luke chapter 11. Luke 11, and we'll pick up the thought there in verse 33. This is a companion verse to what we just read in Matthew, but it's put a little bit differently. Elements are added, so I wanted to read it as well. Luke 11, verse 33, Christ again says, "No one, when he has lit a lamp, puts it under a secret place or in a basket." Doesn't do us any good, does it? I mean, how many times have you maybe turned a light on in a room and you leave the room? The light's not doing you any good, is it? It's just wasting energy. Or in a closet, you're looking for something, you find what you need, you get distracted, you close the door. The light is still on, but it's not serving any purpose. He says, "Rather than hiding it, put it on a lampstand that those who come in may see the light." Verse 34, "The lamp is the light the lamp of the body is of the eye. Therefore, when your eye is good, your whole body is full of light. But when your eye is bad, your body is also full of darkness." we exemplify what we internalize. It's reflected all around us. And we can oftentimes forget the example that we are, especially, it seems, at times when we're not around God's people. But I still remember when I was attending Ambassador College in Big Sandy years ago. Big Sandy campus was out in the country. It was more separated. But from time to time, you'd go into town for various things, whether it was to go shopping or occasionally to go see a movie or whatever it happened to be. And we thought, as students, that we would just kind of blend in. We never blended in. They knew as soon as we walked up who we were. A lot of it had to do with our mannerisms, the language we used, how we dressed. We didn't think anything of it. And yet, in that way, it was very much a light. They knew who we were, and they paid attention to it. Before I develop this analogy of light any further, I want to back up and give some science, if you will, behind some of this business of light so we understand it a little bit better. Light is generated fundamentally when atoms become excited enough to release photons. And you can look back to the early 1900s and see how much we've learned in terms of science in the last 100 plus years. But this is one of those things that scientists really still don't understand. Light itself, how it works, and these sort of things. But there are some elements of it that we do understand. What you and I call light versus darkness, you know, when the sun comes up, that light is actually one small part of this electromagnetic spectrum that I have on the screen here. And there's a whole range of this. And visible light is only the part of the spectrum that human eyes can see. There are some animals that can see other elements of it. Bees, for instance, can see some of that ultraviolet spectrum. Other animals can as well. But that whole range includes radio signals. We don't think of that as being on the light spectrum, but it is. X-rays, gamma rays are on the other end of the spectrum. And so you have this whole spectrum of different aspects of what we call light. But that visible light portion is just a very small part. But for us, it can be a very beautiful part of it. It's a rainbow on the screen. What we see as visible light is broken down into colors. And there's a whole science behind this as well. Red has the longest wavelength and violet has the shortest. And so below red is the infrared. That's why it's called infrared. Below red, wavelengths. Above violet is the ultraviolet, which is why it's called ultraviolet. So when you think about it, we only have the ability to see just a very narrow spectrum of this. But when you take what we see as light, they call white light, and when you shine that through a prism, or if you catch the edge of a pane of glass, or somehow you split that light, then we get a rainbow. And that's essentially all a raindrop is doing, because of the angles we see the different aspects of light within it. So you get the Roy G. Biv of the different colors. And when you put it all together, you get white. Conversely, when you take all of it away, we get black. We get darkness. And so that's, in a very simple way, how all of that works. Now, how you and I see light is because of how God designed our eyes. And our eyes are very unique. Not the only unique eyes in the creation, but certainly our eyes are unique as well. How we see light is that this light strikes the back of our eyes, and there are receptors on the back of our eyes called cones. There are also rods as well. These all play into taking that information that's in that light spectrum, and our brain then processes that very quickly and generates an image, if you will, in our mind. As far as seeing color, what we see is reflected light. We don't think of it in that way, but say you're looking at a red rose. That red rose absorbs all of the light spectrum except red. Red is what's reflected back, and so we see it as red. On the ultraviolet or infrared spectrum, it would look different, but for us, that's the way it looks. And so the same thing works with all other aspects or elements of that light spectrum. Scientists have been trying for a number of decades now to create a true black. And they're getting closer and closer and closer, but they're not quite there. But there's a whole science behind that, because everything wants to naturally reflect some element of light. So what they're trying to do is absorb all of light. That's a whole another interesting topic to look at. But this pertains, this aspect of how we see light, pertains to our understanding of a light bulb, even, for our discussion today, because the light bulb itself reflects. It also generates heat. One of the problems with the incandescent light is that they're very inefficient. You use a lot of electricity to create that light, and it's created, most of that energy is converted into heat. How many have tried to replace a light bulb that burned out and you didn't give it enough time to cool off? There's a reason why that hurts. Those bulbs can get as hot as 3,000 degrees. So they cool off quickly, but still you have to let them cool. And that's part of why the economy around us is shifting away from that in terms of saving money. LED lights and other lights, even like fluorescent lights, are becoming more popular. There's an interesting quote along this line. I'll put on the screen there for you if my slide will get there. It simply says, some people change their ways when they see the light, others only when they feel the heat. Which is very apropos for the example of the light bulb that we're talking about. Let's go to another verse here in Luke 11. Let's move down to verse 35. Christ there then tells us, cautions us, he says, therefore take heed, speaking of this light, take heed that the light which is in you is not darkness. Now that seems incongruous. If we're talking about light, then there is no darkness. But obviously he's talking about more than just this visible light that we're drawing the analogy from. It is a reflection, if you will, of what people see us as. Light, as I mentioned, can be on different spectrums. I'm sure most of you have seen a black light and how that changes colors. It'll make things very odd to our perception because we don't normally see them in that way. I mentioned the filament and the heat that is generated in these bulbs. Only 10% roughly of the energy put through a typical incandescent bulb is given off as visible light. So you can see why they're so inefficient. The LED lights are very expensive right now. I'm sure those will go down in price as that technology becomes more commonplace. But one of the benefits of the LED light is that they don't have that electricity being pushed through them at such volume. They typically don't burn out as quickly. So, for instance, even in our house, I had one light. I don't know what they did to it. I suspect there's a connection in there that's creating a problem. But I would get maybe 2 or 3 months out of a light bulb before that bulb would burn out. It's in our entry area. And so it was a light we used all the time. I finally got tired of replacing those, and I said, I'm just going to get an LED light, which was much more expensive. That was about 2 years ago, and I haven't had to replace that light since. So you can see the difference in these things. Fluorescent lights are very interesting as well. They use a coating of mercury within the bulb, and the electricity excites the mercury and creates a fluorescent reaction, which is why you get that. The interesting thing is that even in fluorescent now, they can generate different aspects of what is called the temperature of light. So if you know anything about light, there's even a temperature spectrum that makes light look cool, looks more blue, or light that looks warmer. It has more of a reddish hue to it. Let's move back a little bit here in Luke and go back to chapter 8. Luke 8 and verse 16. Christ again touches on this element that he mentioned earlier about hiding a lamp. He says, no one, when he has lit a lamp, covers it with a vessel or puts it under a bed, but sets it on a lampstand that those who enter may see the light. Again, making this light of the most possible value. Now you might say, well, why would someone hide a lamp? Well, I don't know. There are all kinds of various reasons. But even in this day and age, when Christ spoke these things, while it was not common to leave these lamps burning simply because of the expense, at times it wasn't worth putting it out. So even with incandescent bulbs or fluorescent bulbs, when the energy crisis came around some decades ago, people would talk about leaving lights on or off. Well, with an incandescent light, if you're going to be gone for more than a minute, it's worth turning it off. You're going to save enough electricity to justify it. With fluorescent lights, not so much, because they were so much cheaper. Sometimes it was cheaper just to let it run. Well, even in this day and age, I mean, you're talking about lighting a lamp. How do you light a lamp? You don't have safety matches. You don't have a Bic lighter. You don't have some way of quickly lighting these lamps, and so sometimes you would leave it burned because the hassle of getting it going when you needed it might be too much. So this type of lamp looks sort of like this. You're basically looking at a small item that would fit in the palm of your hand. That's about how big that is. And so it's almost like a gravy boat, if you know what that is. So you'd have an opening at the top that you can see there towards the right. This opening, I guess my pointer's not working. But the opening at the top right is where you would pour the oil. And then on the left, you would have a wick, usually cotton of some woven type, like a small piece of rope, that you would have pushed in that hole. The bottom of that wick would set in the oil. The reason why it's called a wick is because it would wick. It would pull the oil up through the cloth, through the rope. And actually, when you light it then, it's mostly burning the oil, although it will also burn the wick over time. And so to keep it bright, you'd have to cut off the charred ends and advance it a little bit, and that would increase the flame. And so there was a lot more care that would have to be taken with these. And so sometimes in these Palestinian houses, the houses during this time in Judea, they didn't have many windows. Glass was not commonplace. You might have some sort of covering over it. The temperatures were more consistent. If you've been anywhere near the equator, you're not going to get the fluctuation like we do here in Wisconsin. And so, even so, you probably only have about one window in the house. They didn't typically live in their homes. Oftentimes, they would even cook outside. If it was too warm, oftentimes they would sleep on the roof. It was a flat roof, typically, and it would be cooler up there. They'd get more of a breeze. So they needed lamps internally, and so they would have lamps such as the example I have there on the screen. Normally, a lamp stood on a lampstand, and this was just in most cases, just a simple, crude post that they would place this on the top. And it would give enough light that you could see things, although not bright light as you and I would consider it. But sometimes if they needed to leave, knowing they were coming back and knowing how hard it would be to restart these, oftentimes they'd take it off the lampstand, they'd put it on the floor, and they'd put some sort of earthen pot over top of it. That way if it spilled, it wouldn't burn everything. It wouldn't create a problem. When they came back, then all they had to do is take that cover off, they could put the lamp back on the lampstand, and they'd have their light already going. The primary duty of the light of the lamp then is to be seen, as we've touched about. Doesn't make any sense to hide it. Otherwise, why have it? So then, Christianity is something that Christ has intended. Our example of living his way of life is to be seen. It should be perfectly visible to everyone around us. And for us, during the week, people may or may not pay attention. But oftentimes, they're paying more attention than we might think, because they hear us use language that's not used in the world. Meaning we don't cuss like they cuss. It's amazing how many times people use that. I don't even think they think about it anymore. It's so commonplace. But even the volume of language sometimes, the yelling that goes on or the anger that's in a voice, even the way we dress, sometimes that's getting hard to do as well, especially for women to have clothing of modesty. But sometimes even the men can fail in that regards. And we stand out. We do. And we should. Christ didn't say you are the light of the church. He said you're the light of the world. Now, it may not make a difference in most of those people's lives now, but what if at some point in the future, millennium or the last great day when God brings these people up, what if he stood somebody before us and said, this was one of my called out ones? What reaction would they have? Were we a good example or a bad example? There's some interesting statistics about what we emulate, even within what we would call those that grow up in the church. There have been studies that done, and one study disclosed, as you see there on the screen, that if both mom and dad attended church regularly, there was a 72% likelihood that their children would continue in that. So we think of a light being a light to the world, but what about a light even within our own families? Between spouses, between parent and children, between siblings, these things have an impact as well. If only dad attended, only 55% would continue at church. If only mom attended, 15%. And if neither of them attended, then the likelihood was only 6%. Now, there are exceptions to all of these things. But this is the general trend that was discovered. The example of the parents and even other adults, this is one thing that can mitigate these things, is the relationships. But the parents and the adults, their example is in many ways more important than anything that we'll physically do as a church. So when we talk about the work of the church, this is one of these things I don't like, the church speak we use. We think of the work being what we produce. Television programs and magazines and booklets, and those are all very important. Please don't misunderstand me. But the primary work of the church is us living God's way of life, God living in us. And that reflects in ways that I don't know that we pay attention to at times. Let's go next to Acts 13. A very similar statement is made here, even as we've already covered. But in Acts 13 and verse 47, it says that, "So the Lord commanded us, I have set you as a light to the Gentiles." Now, Christ originally in his ministry was speaking primarily to a Jewish audience. He was only using this as an example because God originally intended to use Israel as a nation, not just Judah, but Israel as a whole, to be an example to the world. The way they lived his law, the blessings that came from that law, the benefits that would spill out in all areas of society because of living God's way of life. God wanted that to be seen. And this is what is being quoted from here. He says, "That you should be for salvation to the ends of the earth." God's ultimate desire is for all of mankind to be in his family. And the way he has chosen to do that is to use initially individuals and then a people and now his church to be an example of why that's worth having. That's quite a responsibility, isn't it? What kind of light are we? Most lights don't create noise. Fluorescent lights will when they go bad. When the ballast starts going out or something's not right, you'll get that buzzing noise. Sometimes even in incandescent lights, you can tell when they're going to pop because they'll start making a noise. They'll make a buzzing noise or something. But generally speaking, they're silent, aren't they? It's not what they're saying, it's what they're doing, which is the example, I believe, that we should emulate. And a light is primarily a guide. We use lights all the time for guides. And it's unsettling when they're a little different. I drove Alicia to work the other day. She had an early shift. And in our town of West Bend, I think it's after 11 o'clock and until 6 o'clock in the morning, they put all the lights on flashing yellow. So you don't have to stop at all the traffic lights. Well, I still caught myself several times. You know, as I looked down the road, I see the flashing yellow. I went to start putting my foot on the brake. Because, you know, in some places, yellow means go faster. But it's supposed to be that you start slowing down. But so it threw me off some because it's a guide. It's supposed to tell me, you know, some information as I'm driving along. We have street lights that help us to see the roads, even in shipping. If you've been anywhere near the waters, even over here, you'll see lights around the harbors that guide the ships, tell them where to go, which side of the buoys and so forth, gives them different information. If you've flown, we have lights all around the runways, don't we? They know exactly where the runway is so that they can be safe. A light is something to make clear the way. So then as Christians, we must be an example of that way, to point people. Even if they choose not to follow God's calling at this time, if he is doing so, even if they're not paying attention, it is still there. That is, a Christian must of necessity be an example I'm convinced that's one of the biggest aspects of our calling. There are many people in this world who do not have the moral strength and courage. And oftentimes in groups, you'll very quickly find out who the leader is and who the followers are. And it's not that nobody wants to be a leader, but sometimes it's just easier to be a follower. And along that line, oftentimes people are simply wanting to know what they need to do. It's easier. Maybe for now, there are a lot of people that don't have the strength or courage to stand up and do the things of God. But if someone gives them a lead, maybe they'll follow. Maybe you hear an off-color joke at work and you're the one that doesn't laugh. And somebody says, you know what, I really appreciate that. Maybe in the course of having a conversation, they recognize and they acknowledge in some way that they appreciate you not using the vulgar language that's so common. These small things can be a tremendous impact, a gesture of kindness to a neighbor, you know, whatever it happens to be. The world needs its guiding lights, and they're fading quickly. There are people waiting and longing for someone to take the lead, and oftentimes if the right person doesn't stand up, they'll follow the wrong person. But they look for someone to take a stand and do the things, oftentimes that they dare not do themselves. A few other verses to turn to here. They're all in John. And while you're turning to the first one there, John 1, let me read to you another quote. I don't have a source for this, could not find it, but the quote is this: I would not give much for your religion unless it can be seen. Lamps do not talk, but they do shine. So John 1, let's read verse 1 there. This is the description of the one we know as the Christ, and John here is giving us background and explaining to us that he was also the spokesman of the Godhead. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and that expression is not very clear to translate. This is the problem with language. It can be a beginning, but what does that mean in terms of individual beings that live in eternity? We can't really wrap our head around that. It says, all things were made through him, that is, through Christ, this Word. Everything that exists outside of that Godhead was created by him. Without him, nothing was made that was made. This includes the angelic spirit realm. This includes the physical realm. Notice verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness. It illuminates. It helps make things clear. There is no ambiguity. You ever been fumbling around in the dark? You get up in the middle of the night, and you're trying desperately not to turn a light on because you know that'll kill any hope of going back to sleep. So you're trying to find whatever it is you want to find in the dark, and you end up banging around or hitting your toe or something. Finally, you say, oh, okay, and you turn the light on, and it's right there, whatever it was you needed. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness doesn't comprehend it. The interesting thing is you cannot, light is one of these really interesting conundrums. You cannot make things darker. You can only make them lighter. Right? So light is the variable, not darkness. And so to continue in verse 6, it says, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness to bear witness of the light. Now, the Word, who we know as Christ, is also referred to as the light, the one who illuminates, who makes things clear, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, meaning John, but that he was sent to be a witness of the light, who was Christ. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. Christ gave us a perfect example to follow. And he set that standard for us. He was a light shining in darkness. And look at the darkness, even on a religious level, that existed when he came. Let alone everything else and whatever geopolitics was going on or even just life in general. Sometimes Christ was quiet and observing. Oftentimes he would do this when he watched the widow drop in her offering and he made that comment to his disciples. He used her as an example of everything she gave. That was very quiet. He was sitting off to the side, and no one was making anything of this. Sometimes, though, he was filled with righteous anger, the example of the temple money changers, where they had basically set up a market outside of the temple. That did not sit well. Sometimes the healings he did were in private, the example in John 9 of the blind man. There was no one else around. And sometimes those healings were done publicly. You know, the example of the resurrection of Lazarus. There was a whole group there. And Lazarus was evidently very well known and respected in the community. Very public. In every case, however, his light showed righteousness in action. He had the perfect balance in these things. Let's go to the next verse there on the screen, John 3 and verse 19. John 3, verse 19, Christ speaking says, "And this is condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and the men love darkness rather than light." We have this as almost a cultural standard now, right? Nothing fun happens until after dark. It's just the way people have decided to structure themselves. But when you think about what Christ is really saying here as well, it's also not just this physical light. They're chasing dark things. The culture of death that is around us, all around us. And the dark things of life. Even humor, how biting it is. But even just look at the world in general, the darkness that's in the world. People don't want to hear truth. They don't want to hear facts if it goes against how they feel. And so this darkness permeates everything. Lost my place here. They love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. Darkness hides things, doesn't it? Don't want to go car shopping in the dark. You may not see everything you need to pay attention to. But everyone, verse 20, that for everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come into the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. And that's one of the fundamental reasons you want a light, isn't it? So that you can see everything. Does our light shine on the evil around us, or does the evil in the world around us overwhelm our light? Let's go to the next verse there, John 8. John 8, verse 12. Christ again speaking here, he says, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Our light should be as Christ's was, in that we illuminate the way for people so they do not have to stumble through life. They may not understand it, they may not follow it, but the example is still there. Oftentimes we'll hear about this when we're in larger numbers, maybe at a feast site somewhere. Business communities as a whole love us when we come into town. Not so much anymore for our money. Back in the 70s, you roll 15,000 people into town, they love you for your money. You're bringing business they would have never gotten otherwise. We're small now. The Dells, we roll into town, we're 500 people. That's not even a convention worth noting in the Dells. It's small. But what they do note is our attitude. They know who we are when we go to the restaurants because our kids are not screaming and yelling and running around the whole place. We're polite to the wait staff. We tip well. We're just a pleasure to be around. And they note that, and oftentimes they say that. That's part of being this light to the world. An example of good, even if they don't understand why it is good. Let's move on to a few other verses here. Micah 7. Make you work for this one. Probably haven't turned to Micah in a while. How many of you start with the first one and start reciting all the names? Hosea, Jonah, Micah. All right, Micah 7. I laugh because that's the way I do it. Micah 7, verse 8. "Do not rejoice over me, my enemy. When I fall, I will rise. When I sit in darkness, the Eternal will be a light to me." No matter what happens around us, do we take comfort in that? Sometimes, you know, especially as little kids, we can be very, very afraid of the dark. And so maybe your parent puts a little nightlight on one of the outlets. And those nightlights are cheap to operate. They're functioning at like a penny a day in terms of the electricity that they pull. But that little bit of light can be very comforting, can't it? When you're not so sure what's happening. Well, what about God? Sometimes he gives us that little bit of light in times of uncertainty, just so we remember that he's there, that the world has not consumed us. Verse 9, I will bear the indignation of the eternal. This life is not always an easy one, is it? People will condemn us. Well, you're judging me. Because you do that, you think you're better than me. That's not why we're doing this. But still, he says, because I have sinned against him until he pleads my case and executes judgment for me, justice for me, he will bring me forth into the light. I will see his righteousness. Ultimately, it's the Father who flows through the Son to give us any light, any clarity, this washing away of sin even that's touched on here. It comes from the Father. But a light bulb generates light because of the electricity flowing through it. God has to flow through us, or we are not going to be a light to the world. We're not going to be that light on the hill. We're not going to be that light that's not hidden under something. It has to flow. This is one of the things that scientists still don't really understand about electricity. It has properties of water, but it has properties of light. It does some really squirrely things we don't quite understand yet. But in many ways, it's simple. The energy from a light bulb produces, the energy a light bulb produces comes from the voltage or how strong the force of electricity is that flows through it. So if you go back to those incandescent bulbs, but even the fluorescent ones, they'll label them. You know, a 20-watt bulb, a 40-watt bulb, 60. That filament only allows a certain amount of electricity to flow through it, which generates a limited amount of light. So how much flows through us? Amperage is the energy the bulb uses to produce light. My dad used to always say, he's probably listening, he said, it's not the voltage that'll kill you, it's the amperage. I didn't take much comfort in that. He liked to work on electricity while it was still hot. I hated that when I was a boy, but you know what? I do the same thing now. the breaker's too far away. It's only 110 till it bites you. So the wattage of a bulb is the electricity flow or energy produced by the bulb. How much light will be produced? So again, what kind of light are we using these examples? Are we a dimwatt? Are we just a little bit? Are we a floodlight? You know, lighting everything up. The next verse there on the screen, 2 Peter 1. You know what, I don't mind those dimwatts because in my house I'm usually one of the first to get up. And especially in the wintertime, it's dark. You know, I'm getting up 5 o'clock, there's not much light around. And I appreciate those little parts of illumination just so I don't misstep going down the stairs or bang into the corner of a wall or something. They still have value. 2 Peter 1 verse 19 there. Peter here writes, and so we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place. See, even in regards to this, why does God give prophecy? Why did he send the prophets, the apostles? Why did he send Christ? What's the point of all of that? So that we see what's coming and we change. That's the point of a lot of light we use, isn't it? On a car, we have lights on the front of the car. Can you imagine driving 60 miles an hour with no headlights on? Don't try it. Unless it's a really bright full moon night. But it lights the way, doesn't it? It shows us what's going on. We're to listen to the things that God has instructed us. We should heed them. We should use that light as a guide, he says, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. Light shines in the darkness. This day star here, as some translations puts it, the morning star, the Greek word there is very interesting. It's phosphorus. Many of you know what that is. If you ever light phosphorus, it's going to burn really bright. This is the type of light we're talking about. Remember the example of Moses coming down from the mountain after he had the conversation with God? His light shone so bright, he unsettled people. He had to put a hood over because he had absorbed, I don't even know how this is possible, but he had absorbed part of the presence of God. Now, God only let him see his backside because he said, "You won't live if I show you my face." As a human being, he would not. But even just seeing his backside, his face shone, and he had to put a hood over it so he could talk to the people. They were frightened. That's Exodus 34, if you want to go back and read that account. We need to take advantage of every opportunity to absorb the light from God and to reflect it back. Every opportunity. Our faces should be glowing. And I think they do. Because people notice, again, they may not understand why, but they see a peace, they see a happiness, they see things that they want in their life, whether they can pinpoint what it is that's different. They're not going to see us like Moses, but they're going to notice something's different, and it should be noticeable. Our hearts should be glowing with joy and renewed. And that's going to reflect then in the things we say, the things we do, how we interact with people. And for us to be lights, we must continually go to the source. You turn that switch off and the light goes away, doesn't it? Right away. How many of you have tried to figure out how much that switch needs to be pressed on the refrigerator door before the light goes out? Right? I know you have. You push it just a little bit and... But as soon as enough of that contact is made, it's off, isn't it? As soon as the source of the electricity is cut off, the light stops. That's a huge lesson for us. We cannot be afford to be disconnected from the source. All right, just a couple of more verses here. James 4, not too far from where we are here. Back up a little bit. James chapter 4, and in verse 8. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Follow the source. Emulate what he has given us, the example that he has set. I don't read this verse as a condemnation. We can read it harsh. We can read it in an angry voice with a finger being pointed, and I don't know that that's the way this is being talked about here. I think this is a caution and a reminder. Make sure. And so as we draw near to God, then we're going to have more access to that source. You know, one of the really interesting things, I've seen these experiments done, I've never done them personally, but if you have enough electricity in the air, you can actually turn on a fluorescent light without connecting it to anything. Maybe you've seen some of those videos as well. And sometimes... even if we're disconnected from God, we can still have access. Not a good place to be, but it doesn't mean we've lost everything. So the reminder is, make sure you don't. Get back to that source. We must be continually and zealously connected to God and drawing to him. Let's wrap up then with Philippians 2. Last verse up there. Philippians 2 and in verse 14. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Can you imagine how different the culture around us would be if everybody simply practiced that? How much whining do you hear in the course of a week? Too much, huh? All right, well then let's hold our feet to the fire. How much complaining and disputing and whining do we do? It's too easy to do at times, isn't it? Verse 15, why? That you may become blameless and harmless. You know, one of the things that God talked to Abraham about back when he made his covenant with Abraham, one of the things that he told him, one of the very first things he said was, become perfect. We think that's unattainable. But we have to define our terms. I'm a big fan of this. What do we mean by perfection? Does it mean becoming like Christ in this lifetime? It'll never happen. but we should get closer. We should become more like him. But this verse is very interesting because it says that if we follow a certain pattern of living, in this case, not complaining, not disputing, we can become blameless, which is the same expression that was used to Abraham. Many other faithful of God have taken on this title, if you will. We're told to be blameless in a perverse generation. Harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights. Although we have the Sabbath and the holy days as a refuge from the world around us, God intends that we be scattered in the midst of this perverse generation. And we're more scattered now than we've probably been in a long, long time. We're expected to be this example, though. Our calling requires that after we have received, we are to give. The person doesn't need to understand the receiving, but they'll acknowledge it at some point. They'll recognize it. Light is not something that can be bottled up, can it? You can't put it in a jar and save it. It's either there or it's not. It must flow through us, and it must then reach out to others. In our case, as lights to the world, to be a good example and to show good works. With an attitude of humility and thankfulness and appreciation of God's mercy, we're expected to extend that to everyone, especially the household of faith, other members of the body, but even to the world. Look at how Christ interacted with the world. There were times he told them, "I'm not sent to you." Look at the Samaritan woman. "This is not my responsibility right now." And yet, because of her persistence and desire, he did. We set an example for others to be encouraged. We're all brought closer to God and to each other. When we walk in the light by living God's commandments, we also express then other aspects of repentance and change. Because we're showing people how to live a different way of life. Walking in the light means being a righteous example by doing nothing other than living God's example. That example is an example of simplicity, isn't it? The really interesting dichotomy about our calling is that it's not complicated, right? There's not a whole standard of things we have to memorize before you can come to any understanding. There are not mysterious rites that you have to go through. It's not a club that's all secret and hidden away. It's a very simple way of life. The hardness comes in overcoming our carnal nature. That's the conflict, isn't it? And everybody in the world is going to face this. Will they use us? Will God use us as an example? What kind of light are we? Living God's way of life means letting God flow through us to the benefit of others. Walking in the light means to live up to the meaning of all that God has revealed to us, Sabbath, holy days, the commandments, his statutes and his judgments, for the purpose at this point of being lights to the world. What kind of light are we?